a granite, which is naturally made, but it does have a different parts of different minerals, and you see that beautiful picture of it. But it could be also a cement or a concrete that has a stone in it or anything there, or a piece of metal. In criminology, in criminalistic proceeding, it is used to discover where people cemented money. Yes, some of the guys actually used the boxes that are made from wood, and they put cement on it in the floor, so it could not be found. But the guy knows where he actually hide that money, and he thought his money are not made from metal. It's not. You don't have metal on it; it cannot be found. That is completely wrong. At first, such a box has a cavity, so it could be discovered by sound, by that cavity that it has in it. And even if you put the sand in it, like a bit sand, in it inside, you still have a variation between that sand and the rest of the concrete. So, yes, acoustic microscopy is absolutely amazing. Then we have also a voice and moisture absorption that we could see. We could actually deal with delamination. And entrapment of air. We have absorbed gases in the structure. So acoustic microscopy is not something that is boring. It could have application in the single person life as well. And to exia.
Well, Wesley, you have to understand, boring is in the eye of the individual. Some people are fascinated by technological inspection devices. Others, not so much. It's not really a consumer item. It's not something that you or I, well, maybe I, won't be purchasing in the near future. I mean, I'm fascinated with my infrared camera detector. I settle for little toys like that. So they're great for industrial use. I don't think we're going to see any kind of practical consumer version of this yet. Certainly nothing sold by Apple.
I'm not sure if that, have you been to the airport lately? They have a booth that they ask you to come inside, and that you see that you're standing, but the walls of that sort of cylinder that you are at are moving, but actually not the walls, but something on the edge of the wall is moving, and you see something is scanning you, and you're wondering, what is that? It was previously, before a few years ago, it was a low-energy X-ray that was scanning you, and now they have a new technology. And one of them is in the field of infrared. That's what you actually have a toy with. And the other one is scanning acoustic technology. So, since acoustic microscopy or acoustic methods of scanning is able to see the depth, when we talk about acoustic impedance, which would be C equals root of Kp, where K is bulk modules and P is density, let me drop. Acoustic reflection at the interface is based on the following. Ultrasound propagating from high acoustic impedance material to the lower impedance material that produce a negative reflection. And the ultrasound propagation from a material of low acoustic impedance on the top of the high impedance material, those generating a positive reflection. That's why those guys who are seeing in the screen in that airport, they are able to see you naked and see everything that you have. But it is not going to tell you what they see. You're just passing by. If they don't see anything that is interesting for them. So we're talking about the certain voids, certain emptiness beneath the clothing that you have. So voids are present in the bone line, or when the I could use the word delamination. I mean, although the word delamination is not really to be applied to the human being, but delamination in terms of the layers of the material that you have on yourself. But also, if we're talking about the table, anything, acoustic microscopy could be used for finding if the laminate on the table or your furniture is actually very good glued, because it could see the void. So yes, this is something that could be applied by Apple, just to be built into the regular phone, so you could see what's beneath if you put this on the table. So let's say you want to see what is the table made from, or what is the particle material made from, or you could put to another piece of electronic or another phone, and you could see the element, and you could read what is on those elements. That means you could see what is inside of another phone or another piece of electronic using a technology that is built into your telephone, if they do that, because the devices are there. I said it's extreme accuracy. You have a lettering on the microchip on the telephone, and the telephone is just a box. It's not the PCB is not exposed, and you could read that. And this is because of sound. Enter a cheer.
Okay, it sounds interesting. I still think it's going to take time for anyone to apply that to a consumer item, because in comparison to my infrared detector, it's primarily a passive device. It's not emitting the infrared. It's simply detecting its presence being irradiated off of every warm body that it sees. And the millimeter waves, the acoustic microscope probably has to generate probably requires a great deal of power to generate those incredibly high-frequency sound waves and such. So that'll be interesting. You know, I mean, there's also millimeter wave scanners at airports. I think there's probably a lot more of those still around there.
Yes, it is, but I want to just finish that before it becomes boring. So a few other applications, we have acoustic micrographs showing voids on the lamination, so we have the moisture that is absorbed by heavies and plastic materials, but we could see the moisture in the walls. So a small device could see where you have an area of interest that is accumulating too much of moisture in the house. And then another application is an analysis that is employing X-ray, radiography, and acoustic microscopy. And it would be like for the doctor to be able to make a regular ultrasound with being able to put on the top of it another layer with X-ray if needed. So that would be the explanation how it works. but it doesn't have to be used for the human beings. We have a package or an electrical product. We have a non-destructive test of any boxes or corrosive particles on the connection, electrical connections, which may pose reliability risk because of the danger of shortening bond wires. So there are plenty of applications, ladies and gentlemen. So if we are dealing with something that has particles inside and is hermetically sealed and cannot be even open, then that mechanical vibration of the sound detects particle impact, and the signal is monitored either visually or on the oscilloscope or audibly via speakers. So those particles could be captured for the study by simply seeing them. So yes, there are plenty of applications for it, and the last one would be polymer properties and acoustic microscopy in illumination. Oh gosh, that's too heavy. Let me drop. That's what actually struck me, and it struck me in the face. The Kuru, it struck me in the face, a sound at 1 gigahertz frequency. A sound in 1 gigahertz frequency. And you would laugh if I told you that, and you don't know me. You would think that I'm crazy. And to actually...
Well, it doesn't require even that. I've placed on the link page, roy.ac2gs.com, entries on acoustic microwave, acoustic microscopes, and proton magnetometers from Wikipedia. And anyone who is interested can read along, and the technology is there. A little bit on the esoteric side, but there. They're looking into all kinds of interesting things. That's the beauty of science. We're in the golden age, if you will. And it's not only bleeding edge technology. We have a story about LIGO, the gravity wave detector, but simpler things theoretically, like electromagnetic waves and acoustic waves that are doing all kinds of breakthrough technology advances.
Yeah, also, this what is right now taking place is a fast visualization of the human organs, not only human body, and that what the human is wearing. It's practically a fundamental wave and the second harmonics versus propagation distance inside the body. So, and then you have a fluid, so everything could be, by means of reflection, analyzed by that software, and a guy simply can come to you and scan you from out down and see all possible problems that he could see in your organs. But that's the theory, the technology is only just taking it as an approach and to action.
Yeah, Wesley, as I said, science is advancing every day. You got to keep on top of it, otherwise it passes you by. There's a lot of the technology that goes into medicine. They're throwing a lot of it at COVID-19, and some of it is sticking to the wall, and others, unfortunately, are sliding down it.
Yeah, but not trying to go to indentation, composite material properties, the viscoelasticity, which is another good subject, or elastic plastic materials. But sound could be used just to shape the flexible materials to their temporary shape, desired temporary shape, and then released. Now, what puzzled me during the inauguration, it wasn't the inauguration, it was the speech of President-elect Biden in Delaware, and they had something that was absolutely amazing. In the end of 90s and the beginning of 2000, I was working on lettering, creating letter signs in the air. So being able to have any kind of a shaping something other than the air that would be visible in the middle of nowhere or in the middle of the air. And I was shocked, although I know all of the methods, all of the possible methods are being done. But then we have a humongous science. If you look at that video, that was a vice president and the president together. Vice president, and Kamala Harris. And there was a big sign, a huge changing shape sign with Biden and some other, and the mob of America and everything. And I was simply shocked. How could possibly that be done? They found something that I didn't know of. If you shoot the laser has to stuck on something in order to create that image in the air. So that was really, really something astonishing for me. Do you recall, did you see that speech? Do you recall that, Dr. Roy?
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to. There was video that I saw recently that was basically a fireworks display running through a lit-up sky that had Biden's name on it. Is that what you're alluding to? Or that might have been using the same technology at a different time? I don't know.
Yes, that is. There was a speech in Delaware of President-elect Biden and Kamala Harris. And she started first, and then we had a speech of Biden. But when you look at that video or that picture or that transmission, on the left-hand side you had a buildings. Then on the top of those buildings, you see, it was dark. It was dark, but you see humongous lettering, Biden or a map of America, or and changing colors, changing shape. That couldn't possibly be something that was like a humongous screen that could be used for the laser to create a image on it. It was like in the middle of the air. I was stunned with it. So that if you could recall that, and then I have a question for you.
NY2H with information.
Yes, Lou recognized. I understand that was basically a drone doing those pictures. But well, what do you have on it, Lou?
Yeah, they were drones. I think they did that during the Olympics in Japan or something also, you know. They're very, I guess they're GPS-controlled, and they're very tightly controlled positionally. And it looks incredible, but they're drones.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the explanation. So the puzzle is explained. Now, I have a funny question. traditionally, we had a president and a first lady. And then we had a vice president and a second lady. And now we have a situation. We have a president and a first lady. And we have a lady vice president and her husband. So, should we then call a president, his wife, first lady, and Kamala Harris, we should call vice president, and should we then talk about her husband as a second lady, and to exchange? It's just in the field of semantics.
I think he's the second man.
Where is the first man?
There is no first man, unless Biden marries a guy.
We don't have a second lady, because the second lady is vice president. Enter it here.
I don't think it works that way. I think there's the president and the first lady, the vice president and the second man. Because you can't really call Kamala Harris's husband the second lady. I don't think people would enjoy that joke.
I agree with you. The only thing is that calling a second man, Kamala Harris and second man, would be kind of, where's the first man?
Again, there doesn't have to be. I think what they're probably going to settle on is something a little bit better than man. They'll probably call him the second gentleman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Lou, what do you think about it?
Yeah, sounds right. But, yeah, we're in a new world, so we've got to come up with new terms. US-2N.
Yes, Paul recognized. I just want to throw out just for the heck of it, you know, what would we do if, say, Buttigieg ran and won? You know, what would we call his husband? But that I divert. Paul, what do you have to say?
Just going back to the past topic about Newsline, you were talking about the woman from Long Island. That was Carity Murray. KD2GUT. They always say her name at the end of every news line. You'll hear her name and call her announced. You know, she's the editor. She's from Long Island. She's involved with Newsday as well. And she did a presentation for Limar a few months back, all about Newsline. It was very, very well done. Back to you, Ray.
Yes, thank you, Paul. Yeah, I remember that. I remember when they were looking for people to kind of volunteer to take Mr. Pasternak's place. Basically, she has the best credentials as far as journalism is involved. I don't think any of the other are employed by news agencies, whereas, as you mentioned, she's an editor for Newsday, so that's pretty good. And yeah, I've heard at the end of a Newsline, they pretty much always mention her name as being part of it. And you know, it's nice that they're keeping it alive after Mr. Pasternak passed on.
Very good. And yeah, and when my daughter, she's an AM2N2WIN, wanted to get the story from the school, you know, the school contact with the Ashgards. A few years back into Newsline, she helped with that, so she had some direct communications with a very nice person. She'll do anything to help you. Yeah, as long as you're a ham, I guess. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry getting out of technicality, but it was interesting for me, especially when Biden called for unification. We are united, United States. There is another question, but I'm not going to bring it here. It's just for curiosity that I don't know. I simply don't know. Can President Biden himself enter Michigan?
Well, that's dangerously close to politics, so we're going to kind of veer off of it as politics and take it as a purely legal theory. There have been people on both sides of that question in the Justice Department back in Nixon's time. Some people thought that it could be done. Other people thought that it can't. There's no direct wording in the Constitution on the subject of limiting pardoning power, but there are aspects of the Constitution that suggest that people cannot judge themselves. So it would probably go to the Supreme Court for an interpretation if it ever occurred.
NY2H?
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, and let's remember that pardoning power is only on the federal level. It does not affect state or other municipality-type charges.
Yes, indeed. Although it is an incredibly powerful tool that the President of the United States possesses, it is solely for federal crimes. It has no effect in states. So if, say, a state wanted to try a person who had been federally pardoned, it would not have any effect on state laws. So if you could find state laws that are broken, federal pardons are useless for that.
The last question that I have is, a corporation is seen as another body. It's not a physical body, but it is the body. And the question is, can President pardon a corporation? By that, he could pardon his own corporations or corporate affairs.
AC2GS. Well, once again, I want to explain to everyone that I don't have any expertise in the law whatsoever, except having seen maybe too many Perry Mason movies or TV shows. As far as I'm aware, again, that would probably end up going to the Supreme Court. There was a recent finding in the Supreme Court a while back that corporations could be considered individuals, and this is, I think, what allowed corporations to give money to campaigns and such. So it would not be a wide stretch that since it's already considered an individual, that it as an individual could be pardoned. Probably even without that, if one were to pardon an institution, there's nothing that I know of legally that limits the pardon power to breathing human beings. So my guess would be it would be possible to do that. Now, if you have a problem in that doing that benefits the person who does that, then you might make a case again to a Supreme Court and suggest that it was an attempt to corrupt justice and have it thrown out. But again, not a lawyer, so don't know what the Supreme Court would do with that one.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
From another non-lawyer who just likes to opine. But anyway, if I had to guess, corporations are generally, or they're chartered on the state level. Lots of corporations charter themselves in Delaware because they've got sweeter arrangements they could make. So they're generally chartered on the state level, from what I understand. Now, if it's an international corporation or, at least a national corporation, I don't know if they charter in other states or if it's just a reciprocal thing that the other states recognize their charter in the particular state that they chartered in. And then, of course, on the federal level, you have interstate commerce laws. So I don't know where that would come in either. Again, I'm not a lawyer. But if I had to bet, I would right now go along with the same thing that it's on a state level. Now, don't forget, state pardons are possible, but then you're talking about the governor of the state. He's got that power. I doubt that in a particular instance I'm thinking of now that the particular governor of a particular state is inclined to pardon some federal official that I have in mind. NY2H back to net.
Okay, this is an interesting line for our present law net here. My assumption would be it's sort of the criminal aspect that you're dealing with, because I'm sure it is possible for a state formed corporation to violate a federal law. I would assume they would then be taken into federal court, and they would have problems on a federal level. So it certainly is possible that the state could preempt the federal case and drag it into the state law, into the state judicial system. But it's probably possible for a state-owned kind of maintained business to break federal laws and be have to deal with a federal court.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So again, if we look at the individual, he may have federal violations and he may have state violations. So he's got both ends going, and of course, again, the pardoning on the federal level only handles the federal aspect of that. So with a corporation, especially now that they're considered persons, it's probably the same thing. So I guess you're right on that.
When you look at the history, we had a number of situations when a president was impeached, and at one event we had a change of the president, but then he wasn't tried at the federal at the state level of that state that he was at. So it looks like whenever the pardon happens, states are respecting the decision of the president, and they don't create any additional harm to the person who was pardoned. If president has a corporations and he could pardon corporations, by that corporations are pardoned, so he has no responsibility in giving a state. Am I right?
Again, the caution that none of us are lawyers, so we probably don't know at all what we're talking about, but keeping that in mind, the only limitation, the only problem is that a federal pardon only deals with federal crimes. So a president could pardon anyone of anything as long as it's federal. If it can be entered in a state judiciary system, that pardon is null and void in that territory. State rights, you know, the Federalist Papers. So if someone were to sue Nixon in California, they could have done it despite President Ford's pardon. They chose not to because, to my knowledge, there wasn't any really significant crime that the state itself wanted to deal with, and as far as I know, I'm not even sure who was running the California Attorney General. It might have just been a Republican anyway, but I think that was less of a problem because most of the possible crimes that he was pardoned for were basically of a federal nature.
So we live in interesting times. We have a first female in vice president chair. We have a first woman of color. And representing so many different races. And we have a a situation with an individual who might be the first former president who is going to be persecuted. But we're going to see. It's interesting time. It is not me that is trying to judge or say bad word or bad or good about the former president. It is just something that never happened. And never happened that were so many voters in the history of the United States. Dr. Roy.
Well, it's interesting to just point out that there is an old Chinese curse that basically translates into, may you live in interesting times. So it's an interesting curse, and it's interesting that it has a Chinese origin. And yes, we do live in interesting times. There are going to be all kinds of fundamental Supreme Court decisions being made in future years. With this new group of people, and it'll be interesting. I would suggest most people should stock up on antacids.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time given to me, Dr. Roy, and thank you, Lou.
You're welcome, Wesley, and thank you, Lou, and I hope the rest of you didn't mind us doing a little Lawnet. I'm sure there's some lawyer out there who's just kind of banging his head against the wall and point, you know, obviously all the absurd things that I might have said. But once again, the proviso is that none of us are lawyers. None of us have gone to law school. The closest I get to being a lawyer is I have relatives in that business. But other than that, not really any expertise whatsoever. So, thanks to everyone for the LawNet. Let's switch back to the ScienceNet. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be more than happy to knock around the topic. Otherwise, I have a bunch of articles from different news sources on science discoveries and such. And we'll run through those if no one has any questions or topics tonight.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Well, we know today Alex Trebek died, and he died of pancreatic cancer, which seems to be one of the cancers that are very tough to deal with. I had spoken to some physicians once when I was hospitalized, and we were discussing, and their point of view was that it's very difficult surgically to get at the pancreas. It's a big deal. And they don't really like, you know, it's challenging, let's put it that way. And here's a fellow who, you know, if anybody had, he probably had some means, et cetera. So, you know, they may have extended his life a little bit, but that seems to be a really challenging one. So I wonder if you have any comments on that.
AC2GS. Yes, indeed. Pancreatic cancer is a vile, loathsome thing. Talk about a man with means. Steve Jobs had a lot of means, and yet he died of pancreatic cancer as well. There's a little bit of an annoying extra for Steve Jobs. Pancreatic cancer comes in different varieties. He happened to, fortunately, if there is such a thing as fortunately, have a version where if he immediately sought aggressive treatment, he had a significant chance of getting through it, which is unusual with most other forms of pancreatic cancer. Unfortunately, he, I think, decided to go holistic for about 6 months, and by the time he had changed his mind, it was too late. And he succumbed to it. The problem, among other things, is that the pancreas is very badly located. It is matted down in the very back of the abdominal cavity. So there's no way of getting to it except through your abdomen. You certainly can't go through your backbone and your rib cage and such. So you have to go through the abdominal wall, push apart loops of bowel, get underneath an edge of the liver, and it's matted down. And especially when cancer complicates things, it's really attached to all the muscle attachments and ligament attachments in the backbone. So it's a mess. And plus, you have to scrape it out. It's a very important endocrine gland. It produces insulin. It produces enzymes that are necessary for digestion. You can live without it, but you have to be put on a series of medications. And it's very difficult to get it all. So it tends to stick around and regrow. So it's a terrible, terrible form of cancer. Mel, K2KEY, is my understanding, passed away from pancreatic cancer. There was another gentleman who was the president of Kings County Radio Club. He was in his late 40s. He died of pancreatic cancer. It's a terrible, terrible thing, and it's very difficult to diagnose, to realize that it's going on. A lot of times people just present with these vague GI complaints or new-onset diabetes or back pain, and it takes a while to figure out what's going on.
All righty, yeah. Yeah, so I that's very challenging, and the fact that it can't be diagnosed early, also, you know, you lose that valuable time, you know, in addition. So, again, maybe the future holds something for us. Maybe there'll be, you know, immunotherapy. I don't know if there are any bright things that you might be aware of in the future to tackle something like this. But hopefully in time, is NY2H.
Well, I certainly hope so. There's a lot of very smart, clever people out there working on it. In the old days, basically they were dealing with the premise that cancerous malignancies tend to have a higher metabolism, a higher reproductive rate, and so they basically poisoned people's bodies with the hope that the malignancy would catch the poison much faster than the slower metabolic rate normal cells. So you have 5-FU, which is a toxic for DNA production. You have all kinds of really noxious stuff, and then you have, of course, radiation. You have gamma rays and X-rays and all these terrible things to kind of kill everything. Immunotherapy is looking like it might be useful. I tend to think that the ultimate bullet, if there ever is one, is a better understanding of genetic science, being able to code gene sequences and sort of custom designing genetic missiles that can seek out malignant cells and blow them up. But, you know, that's still in the very, very early stages of people scratching their head and trying to figure out how the heck to do something like that. But I think immunotherapy is presently being tried in different ways, but I think genetic resequencing in some form is going to be the ultimate solution, I hope.
Yeah, very good. We have CRISPR, and I guess, you know, they're honing in on other techniques. And I don't know, some people may see this playing God. It's going to be an incredible future, I'm sure. There'd be a lot of things that I would have liked to have known, but they're going to outlive me, or, you know, I'll be gone. But I can imagine a future. And again, it could go a lot of different ways, but I think on the science level, we're going to be, you know, if we don't kill ourselves other ways, we're going to have some fascinating stuff. But anyway, what are you going to do? All right, thank you, Roy. NY2H.
You're welcome, Lou. And, you know, like I always say, Hammer is very useful. You could build a house with a hammer. You could also bash in your neighbor's skull with a hammer. So any tool can be used or misused. And a proper understanding of genetic sequencing kind of opens the doorway to just about any or everything that any science fiction writer has come up with biologically. You could re-engineer human beings. You can do the island of Dr. Moreau. You can do terrible things and great things. And unfortunately, human beings being human beings, I assume we're going to do a little bit of both.
I have a question for you, Dr. Ryan.
Yes, Wesley?
Genetic similarity between humans and non-human primates, but also other individuals belonging to mammals. Could you say a few words about it?
Yeah, the genetic sequences of our cousins, the gorilla and the chimpanzee, are very close to human beings, approximately 99%. It's kind of difficult to have a definitive number because there's a lot of random DNA sequences going on, and a lot of sequences are not specific to simians. But mammals in general, and a lot of the sequences are kind of non-specific for most life forms because there's a lot of things that single-celled organisms do that we do as well. And so we code for similar enzymes and such in our DNA. So the gene sequence between us and the gorillas and chimpanzees is very, very, very close, which hopefully should make people a little bit more humble, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Genetic similarity between humans and non-human primates makes non-human primates uniquely suited, as you said, for research or complex physiological and behavioral phenotypes. The similarity of the human to our primates is 95% to 99%, depending on the sequences that were evaluated by Clean in 2007. But what actually struck me is in that area was that rodents share 85% of human genomes. I don't know if I properly pronounce the word genome. From genetic point of view, non-human primates have last four advantages relative to human. I don't want to read that, but if rodents have 85% of human genomes, then the history of evolution is straightforward. Thank you.
Well, I would hope that people kind of at this point finally give in to the inevitable. Yes, it is. Not that we evolved from rats. We didn't. But we have common ancestors. And as I mentioned before, mammals existed at the very end of the age of the dinosaurs. They were small and rodent-like, not necessarily rodents, but rodent-like. And over time, especially after the meteor fell, all the large creatures died off, and the small foraging creatures took over a lot of niches and evolved into different sizes, large and small. And the mechanisms for all mammals are incredibly similar. Again, that they all reproduce identically the same. They have basically very similar organ systems. So it's just the details that are different. And there's no massive difference like, we don't have gill slits. We're not reptilian, although the neuroanatomy of some aspects of our brain kind of speak of a time that we evolved from reptilian-like creatures. But you can pretty much put together the evolution of animals, and you know, it's rather obvious that we have a lot in common with almost any mammal. We have less in common with creatures that have an external skeleton. We have a lot less in common with invertebrates. And as you go farther and farther back, single-celled amoebas and such. But there's still an overwhelming number of sequences that serve almost the same purpose, because each cell has to do very much the same thing in our body as individual cells do in single-celled organisms.
Talking about non-human primates, baboons, B-A-B-O-O-N-S, primates comprising the genus Papio of the 23 genera of Old World monkeys. And there are five species of baboons commonly known as Hamatreus baboon, Guinea baboon, olive baboon, and yellow baboon, and Chacama baboon. But when we're talking about the dead, we could go actually to genetic similarity to humans, which is approximately 96%, relatively large size, capable of providing ample fluid and tissue samples. So the baboon served as an ideal experimental model for over three decades, since 1979. And they also served as a model primate in approximately 6% of researchers involving non-human primates. That was by Carlson in 2004. The thing is that I still don't see the connection between rodents that share 85 of a human genome and your statement saying that we are not, we didn't come from rats. So where did we come from? Would that be that rats were another mammal from the same group of mammals that human belongs to, but they were just going into the different route and direction?
In a word, yes. Basically, just look at it like branches coming off of a tree, branching off and branching off and branching off again. Back in the age of dinosaurs, there was a much smaller number of mammal creatures, creatures that gave birth to live babies and suckled them with their mammary gland. And they evolved into a series of different types of mammals. And those evolved and branched off into other groups of mammals. And so you have millions of years ago, the common ancestor to both us and the rat existed. And when the future generations kind of evolved separately, that was where we made our divide. So it's somewhat like saying that you're not you didn't come from your cousin. You have a common ancestor with your cousin, but you didn't come directly from your cousin.
Although mammals share overall genetic similarity, there are important differences between mice and men, particularly in immune system. So my question to you is, since we have a flying mice in somewhere in China that has amazing immune system and is able to hold COVID-19 or any other diseases, but is not those diseases are not affecting. Question is, since this is the same group of mammals, only flying one, then would we, use that 86% of similarity to human being to create a system of immunity similar to them and to a sheep.
Well, I don't think it's that simple. You pretty much have to kind of figure out what's the difference between our immune system and theirs, which probably is going to take hundreds of years because it gets complicated, as most science does, and then see what the genomes that code for the specific differences, if they work with ours, because the mechanism that they use might be completely different. You know, 15% difference genetically is a heck of a lot of genetic difference, and so there's a lot of things that just don't correlate. So I don't think it's as simple as finding out what the magic gene is in a bat. I assume you're talking about bats when you call them flying rats.
That is correct.
Well, you know, bats aren't identical to rats either. You know, they're closely related, but they're not identical.
Yeah, interesting is how evolution made us.
Okay. I mean, the problem with people generally is we tend to have high opinions of ourselves. So we sort of think that evolution is designed primarily to create us. Not necessarily. Yeah, evolution is designed to fulfill ecological niches. So the world gives off a ecosystem, and evolution kind of tugs at what's living there to optimize its survivability. And those that branch off in wrong directions and have a lower survivability die off. And so there's nothing particularly, unfortunately, special with human beings. It apparently was very effective to grow a bigger brain. It's a terrible price that one pays for it because it requires a great deal more calories and oxygen supply to run. Brain tissue has a very high metabolic rate. And also it's a bit of a pain in the backside for the poor women who have to give birth to the children, because if you gave birth to a fully matured baby, it would probably break her pelvis. And that's why when babies are first born, parts of their skull are not fused together. They can slide and squeeze and squish and get through the birth canal. So you have to pay a big price for our big brain. The only thing is that big brain has paid off at this point. If that big brain eventually gets us all killed, it won't, but we'll see that. Someone will.
Okay, so all mammals are genetically similar. A chimpanzee DNA is the closest to human. They have 98% similarity. Mice DNA is 92% similar to human. All humans share 100% of genes with each other, but the slightest difference in sequence is responsible for changes between individuals. A single nucleotide change can produce different hair color or disease. Question. What are those slight differences?
Okay, this kind of goes back to a couple of years ago when we were somehow talking about DNA. DNA is the oxyribonucleic acid. It is basically four base pairs, adenine, thymine, tyrosine, and guanine, and based upon triplets. How you arrange the three base pairs defines the protein that it translates to. So you have a string of codons. They get read by messenger and RNA, and you produce proteins. If something happens to damage your DNA, there are mechanisms for repair. They are not 100% foolproof. And sometimes the replication is wrong, and some things get screwed up. If it happens to a sex chromosome that's fertilized, the next generation has that.